Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now entered the House of Mystery. with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is here.
Present. Yeah. How are you doing, Al?
I'm doing good. So you haven't been driving into any Apple stores lately, have you?
No.
You know, stay away from that. That's terrible.
No, that's
Boston.
Not good.
Yeah. Somebody did.
Yeah.
I thought it was you for a minute.
Yeah. No.
No.
No, I'm not. I'm nowhere near that area.
No, they don't let you in that area.
They don't let me there. No, they don't let me in.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. Got to stay away from that. And you're not wearing white when you go out, are you? It's after Labor Day. Okay.
No.
Good.
No, I looked that up, and it seems like, you know, it was to differentiate between the upper and lower classes.
Oh.
Wearing white after Labor Day. Yeah. I guess it was like more of the working classes. Yeah.
Oh.
According to what I read on. You know, Google or Wiki or whatever it was.
Oh, well, it's probably true. If it's on the internet, it's got to be true.
It's all true. It's all, yeah, exactly.
Well, today we have a guest from Norway, and she's got a new book out called All the Blood We Share. Sounds pretty scary. So let's welcome Camilla Bruce. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Camilla. Now, you like writing scary stories, or what's? It looks like you've written a lot of them.
Yeah, I do. I do like to explore the darker side of things. Yes.
Wow. What happened in your life to make you want to do that?
Well, I think some of us are just wired that way, that we think we can learn a lot or find new things in the dark things that a lot of other people don't necessarily want to look at or touch.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that out there. So do you take kind of the common, let's say, the common myths and beliefs and dark literature out there and dark fairy tales and stuff? Do you take the common themed ideas and run with them, or do you actually make changes to them?
I do make changes to them, and I think especially when you think of myths and fairy tales. They do tend to change over time and have always done so because society changes and people changes and we need something new from our stories.
Where do fairy tales come from in a sense? Where do the dark fairy tales, like if it comes from society, it comes from folk, where do people just make them up? Like, and is it to like scare kids or into doing something good or bad? Like where do they come from?
I think part of it is that they are cautionary tales, you know, to make kids stay away from water or whatever. But I also think there's an aspect of it, which is that people really like to listen to or make up dark stories because they give a thrill, and especially in a time where we didn't have TVs or internet or that much entertainment, I think that listening to these stories around the fireplace sort of feel that need for excitement.
It seems to tie in too with a lot of things like, you know, occult and witchcraft and things like that. There seems to always be a crossover with that.
In my work, you mean? Or in fairy tales in general?
Well, just in general.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that people have always been fascinated with powers that you cannot see, things that are hidden and not apparent to the naked eye. So I think there's a fascination there. And of course, back in the days, there was also an aspect of caution there as well, because they did believe that these things were real, very real at times. So I think it was like sometimes you have fairy tales about wolves or bears or other things that can kill you. And I think stories about witches in some ways feel that same function. So you were to sort of know the nature of the beast. If you met it, you knew what it was from the stories, including the witches.
Yeah, it's interesting. So let's talk about this new book you've got, All the Blood We Share. Tell us a little bit about the premise. Like, what is the book about?
Yeah, All the Blood We Share is actually based on a true story, something that happened in Kansas in the 1870s, early 1870s. And it's about a family of four who came there to settle. And no one really knew where they came from or what their background was, besides the fact that they came from Germany originally. So only one of them spoke proper English. The rest spoke mostly German. And they settled down in a very small house, or more like a shack in the prairie, where they operated a roadside inn. But it was not an inn like you think of an inn today. It was more like you could pay to get a meal and sleep on the floor, sometimes outside. So it was very, very simple, but also pretty common back then. And after they had been there for a while, people started noticing that people, travelers, disappeared off the street, off the road. And they also found some bodies in the river and out on the prairie, left there. And slowly but surely, it became apparent that this family, the Bender family, had something to do with these disappearances.
When you write a story like this, how do you get into the minds of the characters, of the people that are involved? Because this is quite a while ago, and they're not alive anymore, obviously. So how do you develop a story around real people like that?
First, you have to look at what you do know about them, which in this case isn't really a lot because they were there for only about 2.5 years. And as I said, no one knew their background for sure. They didn't really even know how the family was put together. Was it a mother and a father and two children, or were they two couples, or were they, you know, they didn't really know. There were a lot of theories going around. But you have to look at what you do know. And what people said. And of course, there's a lot of rumors and lies in the wake of something dramatic like what happened with the Benders. And then you have to sort of try to figure out or see if you can see the shape of someone in that mix. And also look at where the story is going, what is happening, what is going to happen, and try to create or craft a character from that.
Yeah, it's interesting. What was your, you kind of come to the conclusion of what, when you look at this family, do you think that they were really practicing witchcraft, let's say, or bad people? Or do you think it was just all fear out of what people didn't understand?
It's a little bit hard to say. I don't think they practiced witchcraft in the way that people said. Because that was, it was actually one of the first things that drew me to the story, because it reminded me so much of European witch trials and transcripts from European witch trials, because you had all these elements that you usually don't come across anymore when you talk about witchcraft, like shape-shifting into cats and stealing milk from your neighbor through rags and things like that, which sounds pretty much like it comes from the 16th century instead of the 19th century. So I don't think they practiced witchcraft in that sense, but I do think because the daughter in the family tried to make it as medium and a psychic, I think that they may have peddled some herbal remedies out the door. And sort of, that's an old trick, you know, if you don't have much, you claim that you have a special power or a special recipe so that you can make a little extra just by sort of feeding that rumor. And I think they may have done that, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have to do a lot of research into the occult and witchcraft to kind of go into what they were supposedly doing back then?
Yeah, there were like two strains there, because the rumors that did exist, they actually corresponded pretty well with written sources on witchcraft beliefs and believe in the occult among German settlers. So that it's clear that some of these old European thoughts and ideas came over with them. And that's sort of where I found this old school stuff. But this was also in the beginning of the spiritualism craze. So that was sort of another strain to follow. And Kate, the daughter in the house, she tried to be a part of that. So I did look into spiritualism as a religion and as a practice, because obviously they were connected to that. And I also figured out that sometimes, because back in the day, it was said that only witches could speak to the dead. So for these people who believe that, the mediums that started having their heyday in the 19th century, they had to be witches in order to speak to the dead. So there's a lot of mix-ups there and some confusion and a lot of supposition. So it was very fascinating to follow the different strains of occult beliefs.
So what did they actually end up doing to the family? Were they prosecuted for the crimes?
No, they were not. They when they figured out that the people of Cherrywell were onto them, they packed up and left. And people found their carriage, the wagon. They had this rickety old wagon. And they found that and the family dog and a lot of belongings, but they did not find the family. So it was a huge manhunt. And the press was following it closely. And there was a lot of reported sightings of the Bender family either together or one or two of them. And there were even a couple of false arrests because people thought they had found some of the Benders and it turned out not to be. So, but in the end, they didn't find them. So no one knows what happens to them.
Wow. That's, it's interesting. What makes you gravitate to a story like this?
I think that in my first novel, based on true crime, In the Garden of Spite, which was about a Norwegian immigrant, so that's why it felt close to me. There was this lone killer who did everything by herself. She set up house, she invited men in, and she killed them on a huge scale. But the Benders, they worked together. It was like a group. So I think it was the idea of how does something like this happen within a family? How do they interact with each other, and how do the family dynamics change when they start a life of crime together? What do they say to each other over dinner? I think that was what fascinated me most in the beginning. Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering how you create your dialogue, especially for characters who are, you know, historical and stuff. Are you pulling from anything from the historical record? Are you pulling from news reports or anything like that, from even other people who lived at that time? Or is it more imagination and just going down that road to create dialogue?
I know some authors, so historical fiction, they really try to make the language as authentic as possible. But my experience is that for a lot of contemporary readers, that becomes a little too difficult to understand, you know. So I'm trying to walk a middle ground there. So it's supposed to be accessible, but also have that old-fashioned flair. But of course, if I find a direct quote from a character, I try to use it because for the authenticity.
How reliable is the information when you get it? Like, because if you go back to old newspaper articles and stuff, I would think that a lot of the media would look at this family as something evil, probably. That would be kind of their perception. So they would probably report it that way. Did you find that was true, or were they pretty neutral?
They were not neutral. The press was furious that the police wasn't able to make an arrest. And of course, they did some pretty bad things. So I do understand that that it was hard to remain neutral. But no, I think that everything has to be taken with a grain of salt. And of course, after something like this happens, there's a lot of rumors that arise. And also, suddenly everyone has been at the Bender Inn and eaten and almost gotten killed, but gotten out of there through luck or their own wit. So you have to sort of sort the stories, what is likely to be true and what not likely to be true. But
yeah, I ate there and I got sick.
Yeah. Maybe something that's not true, I can still use it if it suits my story. So that's the upside to not writing completely realistic. Yeah.
Well, what did they actually get accused of doing, or what did the townspeople think that the Bender family had done? How many people had they killed, or what was it that they had done to people?
They had, when they had guests at the inn that they thought had money on them, because a lot of people were traveling with large amounts of money at that time to buy land or things like that, they would feed them and make them feel at home. And then, according to legend, one of the Benders would come up behind a curtain which they had, which separated their private quarter from the front of the inn. There was a canvas curtain. And the person behind the curtain would strike with a hammer in the back of the head of the person who sat there eating his dinner. And when he got sick from the blow, they would tip him back into a shallow cellar that they had under the house. And then they would cut their throat. And they did that several times. So in addition to the body that was found in the river and the two bodies that were found in the prairie, they found about 10 or 11 people out in behind the Bender Inn. So they were at it for quite some time.
Now, the people that they found in the back of the Bender Inn, how were they killed?
They were killed with first a hammer blow to the head, and then the throats were cut.
And the police didn't find any evidence or couldn't charge them with anything, eh?
Well, they ran away, so they couldn't. But it was clear that it was their doing, yes.
Were there any surprises that you found when you were doing the research on this story?
I think the biggest surprise, there were some of them. I was constantly surprised. But what surprised me the most was that it was them, because the people of Cherrywell, they were worried that people disappeared off the road, and they were suspicious. But they never sort of figured out that it was the Benders, and that's very curious to me.
When you finish writing this book and you get it out and stuff, does it change your attitude toward people you meet on the street or people that your neighbors?
I do think that maybe you get a little bit suspicious, but then again, it's very rare that people you meet are serial killers. That's the ultimate bad luck. But I also think that one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to these stories about the serial killers is because we think of them as monsters, which they are. They're definitely monsters. But I'm also curious about where is the human in the monster? Where does the line go? Where does the person end and the monster begin? And that's sort of what draws me to them, because I'm curious, because they're so different from us.
Yeah, do you ever wonder why a serial killer does stuff like that? And in this particular case, if it's all true, you have a family of four or four people that are doing it all as one unit. So why four people would get together and serial kill per se? Do you ever wonder how? And yeah, because I always wonder, how would that conversation come up?
Yeah, I think that the rumor goes that they already had a shady past, that one of them had killed someone in Pennsylvania. And I think that makes sense, that things like these, they are like accelerating. It's maybe start small or with just one thing or two things. And then you sort of, I think it's the same thing as in a cult, you know, that your boundaries are being pushed all the time because other people took you into it. And it's like, maybe seduce each other into thinking this is not so bad if you look at it from this or that angle. So I think that when there are several killers who work together, they are able to coax each other into it in a way. I think they start small and then it just snowballs.
Yeah, that must have been interesting dinner talk around the Bender family.
Yeah.
At the dinner table, you know, like. So what do you think when you do something like this? Does this make you want to write another book in the same sort of genre?
Yeah, this is actually my second one based on true crime. I did one before on Belle Gunness, a female serial killer who originally came from Norway, from the same part of Norway as I am from. So she felt sort of relatable to me, in a sense, to a certain point, yeah. And it is slightly addictive because you get this mixture of thriller and true crime and historical fiction, which I think it's really fun to work with.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, when you're doing these historical crime fiction type novels, how much literary license do you need to take to dramatize the story, or are you able to kind of stay in the, within that true arc of the story that happened in real life?
So I had to take a lot of creative liberties, but in my first book, there were a lot of more facts known, so I could sort of piece together what I had. But then too, you had to, you know, even if you know the facts, you don't know what they thought or how they felt or who they were when no one was looking. So that's things you have to make up. And especially in terms of motive, because it's not always clear. Yes, it's the money, but is it just the money? Would you do something so horrible just for money? And then you have to sort of look into them and try to come up with reasons that aren't readily apparent.
Yeah, it's strange, you know. How did you get into writing, period? Where did it start for you?
Writing in general or, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like writing books.
I think I've always written, but I was a late bloomer because I didn't get serious before I was in my 30s. And also because I live in Norway and I've always been drawn to, as we said, sort of dark books, and I also write speculative fiction, you know, dark fantasy and horror, and it's not really a market for that in Norway, so it has been quite a journey because I had to look outside of my own country to find my markets. I think writing and expressing myself in that way has always been something I have done and something I probably always will do. So it's really nice to finally be at a point where I can share my stories with readers.
Yeah, and America is always a good market to sell murder. there's always some people interested in there. Big market, you know. So where to next? What's coming up next after this book?
Right now I have been focusing a little bit on my speculative fiction. So I've been working on a horror novel. So, but I do have an outline for a new historical murder book, which I hope to be able to start writing really soon. Since it's not, nothing is decided yet, as they say, I don't know if I can share anything more than that, besides the fact that there's more in the room.
There's more coming. Now, do you do social media? Do you have a website? Do you interact with readers? And if so, what is the website and what social media platforms are you on?
My website is CamillaBruce.com. And I'm mostly on Instagram. And that's CamillaBruce_writing. But you can go there from my website as well. I'm also on Twitter, but not as much as Instagram.
Yeah, a lot of people don't seem to be on Twitter as much these days.
Yeah.
things are going on there, you know. But certainly interesting. So if someone had never heard of you before, what book would you tell them to pick up to kind of get your your type of writing?
That depends on what am I writing you're interested in. As I said, I write in two different genres, and I know that not everyone who likes my historical books likes my speculative work, and vice versa. So if you want to write something more fantastical, I think I would have started with my debut, You Let Me In, which is a dark fairy tale. And if you're more into historical fiction, I think that even though there's a lot of me in All the Blood We Share, I also think that you will get a better idea of who I am as a writer in The Garden of Spite, which was my first true crime-based novel.
Well, do you put a lot of your own character in true crime books, more so than this fiction, speculative fiction?
No, I think it's about the same, but different versions of different sides, I think. There are different, very different books, and I use very different parts of me when I write them.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and hopefully everything goes well for you. The book, of course, we were talking about is All the Blood We Share, and our guest is the author, Kamala Bruce. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Thanks, Kamala.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.